You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 572. Everything becomes creative if the person doing the job is Sidney Lumet.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Indie Film Hustle Pro, our private and growing community for filmmakers and screenwriters. It was created for film creatives like you to meet, network, and support each other, learn from film industry experts, and to get the answers to your burning questions and more. The journey in this business is rough. There is no guarantee to success, but your chances of reaching your goals dramatically improve when you find others who are on the same journey as you and you work together towards a common goal. That is why I put together IFH Pro. Inside, you'll get professional networking, private and safe spaces to discuss the film business, access to advanced tools and education, up-to-date education, exclusive content not available publicly, access to IFH Pro workshops, webinars, special guests, and so, so much more. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro. Today's show is also sponsored by Frameset. I don't know about you guys, but as a director, I'm always looking for ways to show my crew, my cast, what I'm thinking about angles, about theme, about lighting, about concepts. And I used to always have to go and get stills from movies and have to do them manually. And it was just a hassle. But now we have Frameset. Now, Frameset is a search engine for movie, music videos, and commercial frames. You can search by the name of the movie, by color, by theme, by tone, by angle. There's so many things you can search by. It is a fantastic resource for filmmakers. So just head over to frameset.app and use the coupon code NM22 for 25% off. That's frameset.app. Now, guys, today on the show, we have one of the most prolific film producers and creatives working in independent film today. We have Miranda Bailey, who is the producer behind Noah Baumbach's The Squid and the Whale, James Gunn's Super, The Diary of a Teenage Girl, The Daniel Swiss Army Man, and Don't Think Twice, just to name a few. Now, I wanted to have Miranda on because I wanted to get her perspective of being a producer in the indie film trenches and what the raw realities are of making films as an independent producer. And she was very frank about her experiences in the business, her ups, her downs, and it is an extremely insightful talk. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Miranda Bailey. I'd like to welcome the show, Miranda Bailey. How you doing, Miranda?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm excited to talk to you about your adventures or misadventures in the Hollyweird business.
That's a good way to explain it.
I'm sure you have a few stories that you can say on air and probably a couple more off air.
I could say it all on air now.
Well, that's amazing. So first question, how and why did you want to get into this insanity that is the film business?
My father was friends with Brian Dennehy, and Brian Dennehy became kind of my mentor of sorts. And I went to the set of Little Miss Marker when I was a young child, and I saw this little girl acting with him and decided that I wanted to do the rest of my life. That was the women that were there were... I think a script supervisor, now that I know who it is, a teacher and the little girl.
Right.
So I was like, so I'll be an actress. So then I studied acting, and then while I was in college, also was directing and writing just because it kind of came out of me, and was producing accidentally in theater. Didn't even realize it was producing. Then moved to Hollywood, Hollyweird, and got very lucky at the beginning. You know, crashed an audition, got my side card, you know, made a lot of money on a commercial with Dennis Leary accidentally. my ego went really high and it crashed real low once reality hit. And started getting parts and stuff that I didn't really have any control over. Mm. And so I decided to start making more stuff that I liked to be in, or to at least be in existence, than be in stuff that I didn't like anyway.
Now,
and that's how I got into producing.
So I wanted to go back for a second. So I love to hear stories of when the ego goes up, because it is fantastic. It's a wonderful ride. First part, at least. Wonderful rise. How did you deal with it? Because I always, the reason I do the show is to try to let filmmakers know that you are in a boxing match and you're going to get punched in the face. I don't care who you are in the business. Punches are being thrown at you left and right. Most filmmakers don't even know they're in a fight, let alone that there's a punch coming towards them. That is one of those, that is one of those things that the ego, when you get that first award, that first red carpet, the first time someone says, ooh, you're like the next Spielberg or the next Nolan or this kind of thing, the ego builds up. What, so after you did that commercial with Dennis Leary and made, you know, a gazillion amounts of money back then, because I know what money was made. It was a national, I'm assuming. So
yeah, and it played on the Super Bowl.
Oh, Jesus. So you were just like, this movie business stuff is easy. Why do people talk so hard about it? So what was it? What was it like just going up? And then what was it that caused the fall of the reality when that punch came?
Well, you know, in hindsight, you know, 26 or 7 or how many years later, I think I'm really lucky that my ego was slammed down so quickly. Mm-hmm. Because ever since then, it's been a massive, you know, climb up this ice. You know, what do you call it? Like ice climbing.
Ice, right? Yeah.
And so, I mean, it really was, I was very fortunate. And, you know, I was 21 or 23, something like that. So, you know, I didn't believe in fortunate. I believed in, you know, destiny. And,
of course. And you were destined, obviously.
Well, I know I'm destined still.
Obviously. We all are.
It takes a lot more work to get to that destiny. I mean, I don't know exactly what my destiny is. I will be a grandma someday, I hope.
Okay, fair enough.
But, yeah, no, I was squatting in this house in Mount Washington. And every morning, it was for sale. So every morning, we were in the basement. We would put the mattress up and slide it behind the washers and dryers or whatever. And then we'd have to be out of the house. And my roommate at the time, and I had just gotten there, like, I'd been there maybe 2 weeks. And she had an agent through her aunt for a commercial. And we didn't look anything alike, like, at all. And she asked if I wanted to crash the audition to see what it was like. And I was like, sure. And, you know, I was like, not nervous because I was crashing. I put on my ugliest dress, you know, so she looked hot. I didn't wear any makeup. I put my hair in long brown braids because she had like short blonde bob and she was tall and skinny and I was like short and whatever. And wrote my name down on the sheet. And then it's like agent, and that's why I wrote like independent. And then it's like their phone number and I wrote my phone number. And I think I was teaching Pilates at the time. That was like my job, which everyone didn't know what it was. They were like, Pilates, what is it? I was teaching Pilates. And I remember driving like on this very curvy part of the 134 that's pretty dangerous. And my like Motorola rings. And, you know, there wasn't really caller ID. And I'm like, hello? I was like, is this Miranda Bailey? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, this is me, something or other. Did you crash an audition last week for the Paradise Larry? Da, 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 da. And I was like, yeah. Well, listen, that is unacceptable. I want to tell you something right now. You don't do that in this town. Nobody does that in this town, okay? You don't crash auditions. I was looking everywhere, spending everywhere, trying to find independent, and I couldn't find it anywhere. And it doesn't exist. And this is just, I can't believe you did it. Don't you ever, ever do that again. And I was like, oh, I won't. Definitely. Just real quick, though, like, are you calling to tell me never to do it again? Or am I getting a call back? She goes, well, both, honey.
That's amazing.
I set you up with United Talent Agency. Stacey's times appear. You've got it on Saturday. You've got a call back.
Oh my God.
You know, show amazing. Up at this place and this time. And here's your agent's number. She's expecting your call. I was like,
this movie business is super easy.
So then I'm like, okay. So that Saturday, I go to the thing. I have one line. The word is the internet. I say the word the internet. I book the job. It's an international commercial playing at the Super Bowl with Dennis Leary. I go on set. I meet this really awesome girl. Samantha was her name. I think we were friends for a while. I don't know what happened to her. And there was another guy on set I also kind of ran into through the worlds. And we're like all at a coffee shop at computers or whatever. And like we would like look up and say the internet. But like Dennis Leary would like walk by us while he was talking to the camera. And it was so cool.
And
like it just felt so like I needed to be there. I loved it. And, you know, and then I had a couple more auditions and a couple more callbacks, but I didn't get anything. And then the commercial department for UTA shut down.
Oh.
And then I had to go find an agent. And
that's when reality hit.
It was not that easy. It was not. And it was just definitely not easy.
So that was the rise and the fall of the ego. And honestly, you're right. It was probably one of the biggest blessings you had is have it at such a young age, because I'm sure you've met a few people along your journey that did not happen to them early on. And they're still dealing with their egos in their 30s, 40s, and 50s and older. And it becomes...
And it's much more devastating for them when things don't work out.
Right.
Than it is for me. I just expect things to not work out.
That's your barometer. That's your place. You're like, this is never going to happen. This movie, the money will never drop. That star will never sign. This is never... Oh, it did. Okay, great. We're never going to get into Sundance. Oh, we got into Sundance. Great.
Yeah. Like when I finally ended up at FDM after like a toil and crazy stuff, which had to happen from like a short that I directed as an exercise to get out of the documentary I was directing that was too dark for me.
Sure.
So I needed to make a comedy at my house. You know, from that short, that's how I got representation with Echo Lake and ICM. And this was, you know, 7 years ago. So like 25 years into struggling to try and, you know, get the right representation. Then finally, like I remember when they did short, this guy Emotes, who I is my manager now, but he was one of the first people I met in Hollywood. And you know, he's big time, right?
Right.
And I would never even ask him or consider him to represent me. I mean, he saw my first movie greenlit that went to South by.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a comedic documentary, and whatnot. But so told me my short to get like notes or something, like to see like, hey, do you want to take a look at this and see if you have any like thoughts? Calls me back. He's like, this was incredible. This was amazing. I want to represent you. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, I want to be your manager. And I'm like, for what? He's like, directing and writing. And I'm like, what does that mean? Like, he's like, I'll get you jobs. And I'm like, really?
Okay. So I don't know, but it sounds like that casting director for the Super Bowl commercial sounds very similar to your manager in voice. Well, that's your impression.
Well, all these assholes sound alike.
Exactly. Now, I mean, you've worked on some amazing projects, you know, Super and Swiss Army Man. I got to ask you about Swiss Army Man. How in God's green earth did that get made? Like, how is that a movie like that is so wonderful? There, it on paper, I can't believe this is a good pitch. it's a horrible pitch on paper. How did Swiss Army Man get made? And thank you, first of all, for having a part in bringing it to life, because I'm so glad it exists in the universe. But how did that movie get made?
Well, you know, it's interesting because that is kind of like the point where my confidence as opposed to ego allowed that to happen. So, you know, I did Squid and the Whale before Noah Baumbach could get arrested. Like no one would even glance his way after Mr. Jealousy. Right. But there was something there. And then this feeling, you know, in your stomach kind of thing. And then I had that same thing with James Gunn. Was Super, and you know, quickly said yes to that. And then Diary of a Teenage Girl, Mari. So these are all either fail, like, you know, no one will hire this director again. They're in director jail, people, or new directors that have a voice.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So I gave Jill Sullivan her first writing job ever, mm-hmm. which never made the movie, but it was from a short story called Courtney Cox's Asshole.
Yeah.
And then I hired her to write Me Talk Pretty one day into a script, but then it didn't end up happening. She wrote it, but the movie didn't end up happening because David didn't want it to get made, but I still own the script. Mm-hmm. But so by after Mari, I kind of was like, you know, I kind of feel like I know it when I feel it. And I had some other directors that I worked with where I didn't have that feeling, you know, mm-hmm. That didn't work. So it was kind of like, I knew there was, I can't explain the kind of kinesthetic feeling in the air when you, or like, you know, you're like, I think this person has vision, like a vision of their own that is unique, which is pretty rare. I mean, I wish I did, honestly, mm-hmm. you know?
Sure.
I mean, I hope I do. I just don't know what it is yet. But so I had done Joe Cedar's Norman, and because he's like a director with, you know, an incredible vision, and it was going to be his first American film. He did Footnote in Israel, which was nominated for an Oscar, which is the most beautiful film. And so Oren Moverman had asked me to come on to Footnote, and on Footnote I had met this, you know, this team of financiers and this team of producers, and who I'd also knew some of them from Time Out of Mind, because Oren Moverman is one of those people I think has real vision as well. So this guy Lawrence, he's on those movies, and he comes into town, and we're at this house. I finally got into the Soho House. Okay, fucking years. All right.
That's how you finally got in.
By getting into the Aspen House, because I still wasn't cool enough to get into the Hollywood House. And there's no filmmakers here, so they needed filmmakers here. So
right, exactly.
I'm still not cool enough for the Hollywood Soho House, for the record. But so
I was invited once.
I go and pretend.
I pretend that I'm invited. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So he's got a lot. I'm like, what are you working on? What do you got going? And he starts telling me, well, this is what I'm looking to partner on, and he gives me one story, and I'm like, kind of seen that before. And he gives me another story. I'm like, that sounds depressing. I love Dan Stevens, but no, that sounds kind of depressing. And then, you know, there were just a couple of these ones he gave that. And then I'm like, don't you have anything like new? Don't you have anything like, he's like, well, I have one, but you're probably not going to like it. And it's something, it's these kids who've never done a movie before. You know, they made a music video, and, you know, it's about a guy who falls in love with a dead guy, not falls in love, becomes best friends with a dead man in a forest, and his boner's a compass. And it's called Swiss Army Man, and he uses the dead body like a Swiss Army knife. And I was like, any actors attached? He's like, no, not yet. And I'm like, what's the music video? And he goes, turn down for what? And I go, Oh,
those guys.
Okay. How about this? Yes. Greenlit. We'll make for $1.5 million, because that's what he made a Diary for and mm-hmm. the Squid for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's two people, whatever. And let's set a meeting for tomorrow. And he was like, really? That's like the last one I would imagine that you would, you know, a feminist be into. And I'm like, whatever. It doesn't, feminist, non-feminist, you know, like being lost in the woods and being so that you're, you know, and I hadn't read the script yet. So that night I read the script, and it was like insane. But if you know that music video,
sure,
you're like, I get it. And the script still needed work or whatever. So Daniel's come in, and I show up at the office, and I'm like, I say to Amanda Marshall, I'm like, hey, so we have a meeting today at 4:00. It's with Daniel's. Who's that? They're music video directors. I've already greenlit the movie. You know, here's the script. And she's like, are you serious? And I'm like, yeah. So she goes and she reads it. And then she comes back. She goes, you're not. You're kidding, right?
You're not going to make this movie.
She's holding her. She's like, we're not making a movie about a guy whose boner tells him where to go, Miranda. We just did talk to a teenage girl. He's like, she goes, and I don't even know how half of these things, like, how does he become, you know, a motorboat or like whatever. And I'm like, watch this. So I play the music video and she goes, oh, cool. I get it. So we go in, we meet with them. We tell them a couple of things about how we, you know, feel that the, you know, it needs to be basically development stuff. Right?
Structure and stuff. Yeah.
And we give this offer. And of course, now this is where the Hollywood douchiness becomes Hollywood douchiness, is where their agents and managers were like, oh, great, we got an offer. So then they're like, well, we want $7 million, and now we're going to shop it around. We have an offer from Quarren Pictures. And I'm like, and normally, if it comes back to, if that happens, then something comes back to me, I'm like, mm-hmm. you know?
Right.
But with this one, I'm like, go ahead, shop it around.
Yeah. Let me know how that works out for you.
I was like, have fun. I can't even get a black woman to be a lead. Okay. Good luck with this. You know, like, so, you know, and I had tried many times and it was hard. So, the companies that will put a lot of money behind things, it's like, they need a sure thing.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And this was far from that. And, they went around for 6 months, chopped it, came back to us. And then we did a budget, realized it was like around $3 million. And then we were like, okay, well, the best thing to do here, because at one point they were going to play the parts, or Daniel Kwan was going to play a part. And I'm like, listen, we really need like a indie art house star.
Darling, yeah.
And then you need your international, like James Patterson type guy, right? And so we went to Paul Dano because Oren knew Paul Dano, and Lawrence was working with Oren, and he said yes. And then we got James Patterson on, but James Patterson didn't want to rehearse.
Oh.
And we were like, but these are like even before a take. Okay. So like, that's impossible if you're the dead body.
Of course.
All of the like,
no, there's a lot of logistics, yeah.
Camera maneuvers and special effects and practical effects and stunts. Like, you have to rehearse it. So we were like, okay, that's not going to work. And I'm like, well, there's that Harry Potter kid. He's valuable.
That Danny guy.
So we called Daniel Radcliffe's agent, and his agent was like, oh my God. Radcliffe has been begging to work with the guys of this music video if they ever were going to do anything.
Oh, wow.
So that was really easy. And that's how they came on. And I have to say that Daniel Radcliffe, I mean, everyone knew Paul Dano was a genius, right?
Yeah.
But Daniel Radcliffe, to me, just blew me away. And watching him work and watching how precise he was and watching his... getting to know him and like his process and being there. And I mean, that's the hardest role in the whole movie. I mean, there's only two roles in the movie, really. Like they both of those guys, Paul and Daniel, like they're champions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No,
you,
they're two.
Dollar,
yeah. They're two titans. They're two titans in the space. And when I saw it, I was just like, how in God's green earth did this get made? Like how in like what things needed to line up for this to be in front of my eyes right now?
Destiny, baby, destiny.
Destiny. It's destiny. So that's a fantastic story. Now I can die in peace that I know how this movie finally got to the screen. So thank you. So there's always that day on set, and I ask this of all my guests, that the whole world's coming down, crashing down around you. Now, most filmmakers say that's every day, but there's that one day that you feel like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. Why am I here? how am I going to get out of this? And it could be a million things. You've lost a location. The actor doesn't want to rehearse that day. Whatever it is. What was that day for you on any of your projects? And how did you overcome it?
Well, I can think of two.
Okay.
The most recent was on God's Country, mm-hmm. where there was suddenly a pandemic.
Right. We heard that. We had Julian on the show. So we heard that whole, because that was his too, by the way. So yeah. What's the other one?
But I had to fire them.
Your perspective is a little different.
Yeah. And we had money in the movie. Our company had money in the movie. You know, you don't know if you're ever going to make it again. Obviously, that's his, same, you know, as him yeah. as a film director. But like for me, as someone who is like, here's eight people that may or may not ever work again. And I have a choice whether or not we can keep going another 3 days to finish the week, risking Tandaway getting back to London or not. Or pulling the plug so Tandaway can get back to her kids.
Oh, God. That's brutal.
But fortunately, it all worked out. And we came back a year later and we did it. So
right,
it all worked out. The other one was on this film that I directed called Being Frank with Jim Gaffigan, which premiered at South By. Uh-huh. The whole culmination of the movie of this guy hiding between these two lives ends up at this one, like, you know, a starling festival in this small town. And it has to be very, very choreographed of where each person goes. We have two cameras. Where each shot's going to be, where so-and-so's place. And we had like found our location. It was near this lake. And 2 days before we were almost done with the movie. And it's like, it's the final, it's like the big scene. And if this scene doesn't work, the whole movie falls apart. But we had really, really figured out a way to make it work with the location. Like this tree here will block him here because we'll be here. This person will walk this way, leading us over here to sure. the popcorn, to whatever, right? But all based on this location that had hills and levels, because that way you could hide, right? Like you could figure out a way to miss each other. So I'm on set directing this scene, which was already insane. We didn't have enough extras for the pool. It was freezing and the extras on their phones. I'm like, it's 1991. Put your fucking phones away. I may have been that, like, I was just like, what? The phone. I'm looking at a phone.
Right.
It's not a book. Put a book in your hand. Somebody, does anyone have a book?
You know, what's a book?
And we kept moving the extras around, you know, like pool in different bathing suits and
time is ticking and money is burning and money's burning.
So lunch break happens and turns out that for the big scene that we're shooting, not next day, but the day after for 2 or 3 days, we lost the location.
Of course.
But they have a place that we can go look at right now, right over here, a park that's available. And I'm like, okay. So me and my DP, your own Sharf, get in the car. We go to the park and it is just flat.
Very cinematic. Flat. Extremely cinematic is what you're saying.
Water. And we look at each other and he's like, none of the blocking that we had before or any of the,
it's gonna work.
Any of the setup will work here. I'm like, I know. And I'm like, so what's the chance of us getting the other place back? And they're, you know, their line producer, the other producer, like zero. And I'm like, so what's the possibility of us not having to do it here? And they're like, zero. This we're doing it.
And you've got to run and you've got to figure it out.
Yep. And that was after we shot that whole day. We went to, Yaron and I went to the park and figured it out until the sun went down. And then the next day during break and during afterwards, we also kept figuring it out, how we'll block it, how we'll shoot it. And then the next day we began.
Oh my! But that's that thing that filmmakers don't understand, that the world is every day something goes wrong. Very rarely does everything go exactly according to plan, because it never goes according to plan.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And I remember the first day I walked on the set to direct my first big thing, and I had a shot list that was obscene. And the first AD picks it up and goes, "Yeah, we're going to shoot about 5 of these before lunch. I know you've got 40. We're going to shoot. So pick the 5 you want. And if you're really good at those 5, we might be able to add 2 more." And you're just like, but I spent all night putting that together. They're like, "Yeah, I don't care. That's not the reality of the world." And I always try to explain this to filmmakers before they go on. Like, it's just the whole world's going to come crashing down. And this is stuff they don't teach you in film school. They don't teach you how to adjust and pivot on the day, second by second, because the costume didn't show up. Food's not there. You're losing locations. The camera doesn't work because it's frozen over or it's overheated. And like, it's just obscene amount of things that could happen. And yeah. And it doesn't really – the only difference is when the bigger budgets is generally on a much bigger budgets, the studio stuff, things still go – I've spoken to those filmmakers, and they're like, "Yeah, we lost the location." Like, even the big – the $100 million movie. They lost. They're like, "We just ran, grabbed the camera, me and my DP and the actress, and we stole." I'm like, "You stole shots at $100 million+ movie?" He goes, "We stole shots at." It's just
sometimes you have to. I mean, this is what I love about camera tests. I'm always like, let's get it set so our camera tests can be usable if we need to.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, that's great. I never thought of that.
Yeah, that's, I mean, really being able to produce alongside produce the movies and watch and learn from James Gunn and Mari Heller and Daniels and Noah and the bad ones. Not that I'm not gonna list, but there were ones made mistakes. There was this one that was too afraid to talk to the actress. I'm like, "Can she stop folding laundry? Like, shouldn't she just talk to her dad?" You know? And I remember he's like, "Well, you tell her." And I'm like, "I'm not the director." just knowing, like, okay, if that didn't work, or like, seeing someone just do bad things to, or make bad choices, and seeing people make good choices, and watching how different people prepare, working with Mike Birbiglia and Lake Bell, both actors who wrote, directed, and starred in their material, and I was able to produce those, they have very different ways of going about how they do it. And that was fascinating. And it definitely made me feel like, hey, you know what? I could do that sometime. And it'll be totally different than theirs. But I've learned from their brilliance. And then the bad things that happen on set with the same stuff, how they handled things. And producing really and acting really kind of got me, was my best film school as a director.
Right. Right. Well, let me ask you a question. As a producer, when you pick the wrong horse in any department, it could be the director, it could be an actor, it could be a crew person. When you pick the wrong horse, obviously the higher on the totem pole, meaning the director, the actors, or the DP, how do you adjust that? What do you do as a producer? You're like, "Oh my God, he's not talking to the actress. Like, what are we going to finish our day? Are we like, how are we, is no, this movie?"
You're pretty much screwed. I mean,
thanks. I love that.
Yeah. I mean, really, it's the script, right? It's the product. Sometimes it comes just as a script and you build around it. Sometimes it comes as a script with the director and then you help cast it, but it's that director's job to really hone it in, and it's my job as a producer to get the director's vision correctly. So even though I wouldn't have made the same choices that Lake Bell did on I Do Until I Don't, my job was to support her choices,
right?
And that's kind of what you have to do as a or the way I look at producing personally. And so I would say one of the most important lessons that I've learned, whether it's producing or directing or even mentoring, because I'm doing a lot of mentoring of people, not through programs, just individuals, is you really have to love it. Because if it doesn't make money, like anything I did, and I have done things thinking, oh, this will make money, never does.
And then, oh, this will never make money.
Where I'm like, this will never make money.
And it does.
But I love it. And it does. So it just makes, and I've done things that, you know, things. So honestly, if you love something, because it's hard, if you love something, whether it's a commercial success or a critical success or not, if you love being there every day, then it's still a win, you know? So, and I'll go back to like, you know, with Mike Birbiglia, I was determined to do his next project after Sleepwalk With Me. I pretty much stalked him, you know, in a nice way without a creepiness, and was like, he could have turned in a bunch of blank pages and I would have just said yes. Like, so I knew I was going to make his next movie, and that was a success. And so we were really lucky. But I didn't know. I really didn't think it'd be, who the fuck wants to see a movie about improv actors? Not me. But I wanted to make his next movie so badly.
Right.
But I was willing to overlook the plot.
Right. That's how you're like, I don't care. I don't care what it is.
I don't care. Because, you know, and that was success, you know, and I enjoyed it. And, you know, became really good friends with Kate Micucci from that, and worked with beautiful people and great DPs and great everything. Like, I love Mike. I love everyone on that, you know, Keegan's rad, everyone. So when that stuff happens, it's really great, you know. And then when, for instance, with Lake's movie, which is similar, you know, it wasn't a critical success. It wasn't a commercial success, but I really loved working on it. And I loved watching her work. And I loved watching, you know, working with my friend Amanda on it. And, you know, we got to be in California, and, you know, Dolly Wells and I became close, and she is hilarious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and so it's worth it.
Now, when you're looking, when you're putting a project together, what do you look for in a director? What are the traits that you specifically look for in a director?
Well, I do seem to do a lot of, first time directors. So I can't really explain it, because it's not like a looking, it's more of a feeling.
Sure.
And it's, if they can see it and explain it to me, and I can see what they see, then I know that they know what they're doing, that what they want. If they're wishy-washy or, you know, unsure, you just feel it in the room. And oftentimes you don't even get to that point, because you already feel it in the writing.
If they're writer-directors. You generally work with writer-directors, right?
Seems like it.
That's generally the way it goes.
I mean, it's not a mandate or anything. It just seems to go.
What is the biggest misconception that people have about a producer and what they do?
Oh, people think we make money.
That you make obscene amounts of money, and truckloads. You've like a Pablo Escobar problem. Like, the rats are eating my money. I have too much money.
Look,
in the house.
I've got mattresses stacked full of money behind me. It's just invisible, with the best kind of money. Perceived success money.
That's the best kind. You can't spend it, though. You can't spend it. Not to a certain extent.
It's like better than Bitcoin, because it gets you into parties and restaurants. And you don't have to pay a thing.
Gotcha. That's the perceived riches of being a producer is what it is. No, people think, like, when you're in the film business, like, oh, you must be making a lot of money. I'm like, no, that's the top one of 1% that, like, make that kind of create, and that's all you see. I always say,
but I will get there.
I mean,
I'm still here, and I'm going to tell you something.
I'm still fighting, baby.
I'm going to set up a show, or I'm going to set up a movie, or something's going to happen where I will make money, like actual money someday. Not like $30,000. I will make more than that in a year on a movie someday. I just got to stick in there. I just got to hang in there.
Another 20 years and I got this. I got it.
I'm trying to do TV now. So I'm like, maybe there's money.
Well, everyone knows that that's where the money is in television. It's always
trying to get in the door of that is like, fuck, it's hard.
No, we
just shot a TV show, indie, 9 episodes that we're selling now. I don't think that's been done yet.
It's been done a couple times.
Stupid idea.
Well, no, it is not a bright. It's not a bright idea, generally speaking. But
I had to. It was a pandemic.
You had to do what you got to do.
Tell the story. It's an LGBTQ+ story. It's about mental illness. It was super important for me.
You'll get it out. I love this. I love that this is such a raw conversation. So people really have filmmakers who just are new to the business get an understanding of what the business is really like. Is there so much perceived perception about the business? And I always tell people that Hollywood's really good at the sizzle, but they suck at the steak. And
great.
Is
that a mug? Because I'll buy it.
It's because it's so true. I always use the example of because I was from LA. I lived in LA for over a decade, and I always, anytime someone came to town, relative, they're like, hey, we want to go to Hollywood Boulevard. I'm like, no, you don't want to go to Hollywood Boulevard. I go, no, that's where the Oscars are. I'm like, yeah, that 50 feet is basically all that looks good. And I go, that is a perfect analogy for the business, because on Oscar night, Hollywood Boulevard looks amazing. But if you go a block over to the left or a block over to the right, you better hold on to the purse. And the farther you get away from the Dolby.
Now it's just insane. But I was there for the Irish screening, the premiere, and I will say it looked just like, the glitzy Hollywood.
Oh, the Chinese theater, of course, and all of that stuff.
That was awesome. But that's the only time I've ever, or like when we did Super, and that was at the Egyptian.
Yep.
But don't go there just to like go see the stars, because you can actually, the stars go on forever.
Oh, forever and ever and ever.
Go to the stars by the good coffee shop.
It's exactly. But I use that as an analogy because it's a perfect analogy of what Hollywood sells. It sells the image, but the reality is, I mean, if you live in LA for any short amount of time, you realize it is a boulevard of broken dreams. So many people go there with these bright-eyed and bushy-tailed ideas about the business, and that reality hits hard, and it's not an easy grind. It is a grind. Like you just said, like one day, and you're, arguably a very successful film producer. And in your, you've done some amazing projects. You've worked with amazing people. You've made amazing films, but you're still hustling it. You're still grinding it. You're still doing it. And I tell people, I'm like, I know Oscar winners who are like, I got to still hustle the next project. The Oscar will get me into a party, but it's not going to pay my rent. Like,
When they were trying to buy God's Country, I remember one of my friends is a distributor who's kind of bidding on it or whatever. They're like, we're planning on doing a awards campaign. I'm like, yeah, well, awards don't pay my rent. I said, awards don't keep the lights on. So bring your number up.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want an Oscar nomination. And give honestly, me another million.
it is, you have, there is an amount. I mean, I do think I'm kind of like a cockroach. And like, I feel like, slowly the world, the people quit around me. And if I can just still be there, then good time.
You're just going to wait everybody out. But you know what? You know the funny thing is about that.
Keep working,
keep going. But you know what? I've said this so many times. I've been in the business getting close to 30 years. And I know people who are less talented than many people I know, but they just stuck it out. They had a willpower to keep going. And that are less talented, less experienced, and they just keep grinding, and they outweigh everybody else. So people are like, oh, I know this talented person. I'm like, talent, man, talent's the beginning of the conversation. It is because there's, you know, a lot of talented directors and writers.
Well, talent is needed. Like, so I have this quote on my website, MirandaBailey.com.
Yes.
I have this quote on my website that I read in the newspaper, in the Hollywood Reporter, that first week I was here. Okay. Yeah. Oh.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And I clipped it out and I have it somewhere in some journal, you know, some pasted it down. And I don't know who said it, someone important probably. Mm-hmm. And it said, talent isn't what gets you in the room, but it's what keeps you in the room.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know?
So I do think I'm talented at this point, but I know that that's not enough. And
then there's hustle, then there's experience, then there is craft, then there's all these other things that you need to be good at, not just a talent.
Yeah, like, you know, basically if you can be, you know, for me, the most important thing right now is authenticity.
Yep.
And that is the hardest thing to find when you first come to LA, probably, for people who are going or getting into the movie business. And it's hard to be authentic surrounded by inauthentic people. Mm-hmm. So, but I think that the pandemic has really helped kind of the world realize what in every business, what they want to be and who they want to be and who they want to be around.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that my hustle was really, really, killing me before the pandemic. You mm-hmm. know, I was authentic, but I was definitely doing things very fast. And I am kind of bad, like this, like Sundance and South by has kind of got me on this again. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Spring break, let's go to Hawaii. Let's like take a vacation, let's get the kids.
Yeah.
It's more important for me to go to the Oscars. Mm-hmm. It's more important for me to, I live in Aspen now. Like, it's more important for me to just, I don't care how much I like the project. If the person involved that is a producer involved or a director or even an agent involved or whatever is an asshole, I don't want to do it.
Nope.
Because my time now, I'd rather sit here and create this movie I'm working on with Oren Moverman, or one of the five movies I'm working on with Oren Moverman, because I love him and he's my heart and soul.
Mm-hmm.
He's like my brother.
Mm-hmm.
That may never get made. Then, you know,
life's too short. Life's too short.
Yeah.
And as you get older, the level of crap that you put up with starts to drop dramatically. When you were 21, you'll put up with a whole lot of crap that you won't put up with at 41 or at 51. And you just start dealing with it. And it's so true. And you really start finding out what's important to you. Because when you're young and you're starting out in the business, it's all about the business. Your entire identity is wrapped around the business. But as you get older, you start to realize, oh, I'm more than just a director. I'm more than just a writer. You hopefully get to that point that you realize I'm a father. I'm a mother. I'm a sister, a brother. I'm a charity. I do other things besides just this. And it takes time to realize.
And I think supporting other filmmakers like has been, you know, or other people who want to be producers, want to be writers or want to be directors and stuff. That's become a great joy in my life. Right. They're not just making their movies, but even just helping them get their movies made. That stuff is because no one ever helped me. And in fact, it was kind of the opposite.
They try to hurt you.
So I always said, you know, if I ever get to a point where I can be valuable enough to help other people, that doesn't mean give them money to make their movies, right? Mm-hmm. But give them support and encouragement, then I will do it. And that's been something, you know, that's Unknown Country, which just premiered at South By. The way that came about with me is I had Being Frank that I directed, and Marissa had Ingrid, which she directed, at the Bend Film Festival. And we were talking as directors. And she told me about her next idea. And she's like, but I just don't know what to do. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm here for you anytime you need it. And she's like, well, will you be my mentor? And I'm like, yeah, of course. And so my relationship on that movie, obviously it ended up becoming later on, you know, bringing on my company and my agency and like finding the right publicist and, you know, now finding the right agent for her and, you know, finding the right festival to premiere at and stuff like that. I'm just so fucking proud of her.
That's, you know, amazing. But that's, because, but that's a joy. Yeah. That's the joy that you look for now. And that's the thing, yeah, that I look, when I started this show almost seven years ago, my life changed because I started giving back. I started being of help, being of service to other people. And then now I get to talk to people like yourself all the time, where I would have killed to have this conversation with you early on in my career. Now I'm just like, this is amazing that I get to talk to you at a different place. And hopefully my intention is not to get anything out of it for me. That's, I don't care. I'm here to have a great conversation that hopefully will help other people. And that's the intention I have with all my guests, regardless if they want Oscars or if they're just a new filmmaker just starting out. And that has been so rewarding, and it's changed my life. So I think you're feeling that too, just by helping others and mentoring others and giving back in that way.
Yeah. Also, it's great because then, you know, you're part of something that you love.
Right.
You know, and that's just what it is. Nah.
Now, how, because you've been doing this for a while now, can you tell the audience how the independent film space has changed in the last 5 years? Not 20, the last five, arguably the last two or three. How much more difficult is it to make a movie, get distribution, get your money back, get, you know, return for your money for your investors? Is there, how has it changed from, you know, 20, you know, 5 years ago?
Well, we're in a very, very state of who knows because of the pandemic.
Sure.
So that's obviously problematic when it comes to shooting things. And if you get shut down because someone gets sick or if there's a new variant, and, you know, we are still in a pandemic, even though people are not talking about it. I mean, my husband and my two kids just got COVID again. And I stayed in South by longer so that I could get to Hawaii for my vacation. So. But I'd say one thing that I think is great about the last 5 years is that the idea of windowing, which it has, you know, has collapsed. So there was for a while an argument about 90 days, which is a real theatrical release, and otherwise it's day and date, and there's really no in between. And then there were people calling something called like, broken windowing, and I'm like, that doesn't sound good. Can we call it creative windowing? So creative windowing, but it was still very hard to navigate. And what people don't understand is when you're selling your movie, you're going to get way more money through foreign and everything if you had a traditional 90-day release, but you had to play in so many theaters and your box office numbers had to be so much money in order for those deals overseas to actually kick in. So as soon as that changed, you were kind of screwed. So for instance, with Being Frank, we released it through Film Arcade and Universal because we didn't want to take necessarily any of the other offers, which is good because we made more money than the other offers by now. But our deal with Universal was a 90-day windowing, which I didn't think would be the right thing for Being Frank. Mm-hmm. But that was the Film Arcade deal. It should have been day and date. But, you know, Universal at that time was doing 90-day theatricals. So now with us being able to watch at home, you know, Marry Me, let's say, the now that the rom-com coming back, which I'm like, hallelujah.
Thank God.
Okay. I need some more. I mean, that's my favorite genre. So I never get to think. But you can put it on TV and still make $8 million in the box office opening weekend. And on Peacock, it had a gazillion people sign up for Peacock and watch it that opening weekend.
I did. my wife wanted to watch it.
They're not releasing numbers or anything. And like, you know, so that's really great. I mean, I think the other thing, and this is probably just for me because other people, like, I want to direct to one of those movies that you're like, oh my God, did you see the Ali Wong movie or the Hello movie? And they're like, oh yeah, I loved it. Who directed it? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, it was on Netflix or it was on this. That is my ideal situation, because then you do not have to be a director, like, with a point of view or say something, or, you know what I mean? Like, be ripped apart or praised in an inauthentic way.
Correct. No, you're absolutely right. It's changed so much. I can only imagine Disney, how many subscribers Disney Plus got from all the Pixar movies and all that stuff, and HBO, that whole last year. I mean, how many people signed up?
They played all the best. They played, like, they had Harry Met Sally. I watched it like 4 times.
Exactly. So the game has changed so dramatically. Is there a place right now, in your opinion, for the, what we would have called in the 90s, that independent, an independent film from the 90s, the Slackers, the Clerks, the El Mariachis, the Brothers McMullen, those films? Is there a marketplace for that anymore, those kind of films?
Yeah, there is. There is, you know, there's Magnolia, there's IFC, Neon's doing their own wing, which is called Super. There's Film Arcade. Those are the ones who are doing those movies. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's self-distribution models out there now that you can do that, you know, because there's nothing, I mean, once someone asked, at South by, when I was on a panel, like, you know, what do you think about the idea of self-distribution through this and it's competing with us? I'm like, look, the more places there are for us as filmmakers to be able to put our movie out there, so instead of it sitting on our shelf or in our closet, it's on Apple or Amazon or whatever, Google, the better, because no one wants to make a movie and not be seen. Now, that has nothing to do with money or minimum guarantees or anything like that, but you know, there's more places for you to see a movie. There's more ability for you to make a movie. The market, the, you know, big sales has been gone for a long time.
Oh, yeah. And pre-sales as well.
Well, pre-sales is a totally different kind of thing. It's not even for independent film anymore.
Yeah. The days of AFM and just having a poster. I mean, unless you have a relationship with buyers.
I know, but you got a Nick Cage movie, you got a Stallone movie, you know,
yeah.
You got
Bruce Willis.
A Lee movie, you're fine.
Solid.
But
you're good.
Know, you know, or a big director. But if it's like you and me making a movie starring my best friend, you know, Zach Selwyn, we're not going to pre-sell it.
No. And you're right. It's just that world is gone. And I always tell people with self-distribution, you got to hit the ball so well to make real money in that play, in that space. You got to really know what you're doing. Really understand a lot of different things to be able to generate $300,000, $400,000, $500,000.
Well, you do the company that does it. So, like, Arcade, we do self-distribution. Mm-hmm. I mean, Bleecker Street's also doing service deals.
Sure.
So, you know, I think as long as you use one of those companies that really knows what they're doing,
it helps
to guide you, then you're good.
Now, I'm going to ask you a couple questions. Ask all my guests.
Okay, great, because I got to go to the bathroom. So,
okay, fair enough. I'll hurry up. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
That was fast. Don't
run away. Get an accounting job. No, you got to love it.
You know, I don't know. My advice is always changing. You know, what I would say is understand that it is a collaborative art. And if you can't collaborate, you won't make it, because what doesn't bend breaks.
What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
That I am not fat. Despite magazines or movies and what they have said, and that I don't have to look like everybody else. And I want to thank Shonda Rhimes for this, because she's the one who allowed people to go and be seen that are real people. Because when I got to Hollywood, I was called not fat enough to be the best friend or skinny enough. So, but I was really funny. So I needed to gain or lose 20 pounds in order to be successful. And I was not pretty enough to be the lead. And those were the only roles for me as a woman.
Wow. And they told you that.
I was told this more than once.
It wasn't like one outlier. It was constant.
That's just the way it was.
Wow.
And life is not over when you turn 30, if you're a woman in the business, you know, behind or in front of the camera. My dad learned how to ride a horse at 65 years old, and he then became a cutting horse champion by the time he was 75 years old. So, you know, just stay on the fucking horse.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, gosh. True Romance. Oh, number so one good. Favorite film of all time.
That's amazing.
Then I'm going to go with My Fair Lady.
I'm obviously both double.
And then thirdly, Some Like It Hot.
Oh, very good. Wow. That's a heck of a screening night. And Miranda, where can people find out more about you and see what you're doing?
Well, my website, MirandaBailey.com, because my dad was smart enough to get my name on websites when they first started. Mm-hmm. So lucky, because, you know, Chandra Wilson would have it by now. has my writing, directing, acting, producing in it. And it also has some information on Cherry Picks, which is a website that I started for female critics to kind of, you know, put them together and give a score for female critics. And that's thecherrypicks.com. That's a really fun. It's kind of like I want it to be The Cut meets Entertainment Weekly meets Rotten Tomatoes for women and non-binary people.
Fair enough.
But it's, you know, we show Swiss Army Man's on there. I mean, Ford versus Ferrari, I'll say, is one of my favorite movies in the last 5 years.
It's so good. How about that? It's such a good movie. That's such a fantastic film. Miranda, it has been entertaining as hell talking to you and also very educational. I appreciate you taking the time out to talk to the tribe and dropping your knowledge bombs on them. So I appreciate you. Thank you again.
I'm about to go drop something else. So thanks so much, guys.
I love it. Thanks so much. I want to thank Miranda so much for coming on the show and dropping her knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Miranda. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/572. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe to the show, and leave a good review. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.